This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, today's extraordinary personal stories come from India, Liberia and the Atlantic Ocean. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister, and I'll be talking to the Tibetan exile who set himself on fire in front of the Chinese embassy in Delhi. Also the former Liberian soldier who's now working for peace and reconciliation, and the French woman who's planning to windsurf across the Atlantic despite her heart condition. First, according to exiled groups, 23 Tibetans have set fire to themselves in the last 2 years in protest at what they see as the Chinese occupation of their country. Six of the incidents are reported to have taken place this month. The majority of those who've set themselves on fire in this way are monks living in Tibet. But there's also a substantial community of exiled Tibetans living in India. In November of last year, 26-year-old Sharab Tsidor set fire to himself outside the Chinese embassy in New Delhi. Police officers managed to put out the flames and save his life, but he was confined to bed for 3 months, recovering from his burn injuries. Sharab has never been to Tibet. As he told me on the line from Delhi, he was born and brought up in the city's Tibetan community.
I was born in Delhi and I stay with the Tibetan community. When I stay inside the Tibetan community, it's something like I'm in the Tibet. Because everywhere I'm talking with the people in a Tibetan language, I feel something like I'm in my home.
And did your father tell you stories about Tibet?
Yeah, he always used to tell me story about what he did inside the Tibet. And my father always tell me when he was in 4 years old, how he escaped from Tibet. A lot of months he run without food. It was hurting me because my father is suffering because of we lost our country.
Do you remember when you first began to worry about what was happening in Tibet? Was there a particular moment or a particular incident that made you interested in the political situation?
When I started to go to the protest about the freedom of Tibet, so that time the Hujinta was came in Delhi. So I went to protest and I tried my best to jump on his car and just give a message to him.
Protesting against the Chinese president?
Yeah. And that time I was arrested and I was in a jail.
So I want to talk more now about your latest protest. What brought you to the decision to set fire to yourself? Was that something you'd been thinking about for a long time?
I did not prepare anything. I just decided. I strongly feel that I have to do something different, which is pass the message very fast.
Presumably you were aware of the people inside Tibet who'd set fire to themselves in protest against the Chinese.
Yeah, I have to do what they did. I have to do same thing what they did. So I strongly feel that.
And you felt that by setting fire to yourself, you really could have an impact. You could change the way things were happening.
Yeah, I think so.
What did you take with you?
Just a chemical thinner and lighter, Tibet flags and press release. That chemical catch the fire very fast. And if the chemical burn, it was very hard to stop it.
So what happened when you approached the Chinese embassy?
On the 4th November morning, when I decided to burn myself, and when I'm leaving from my home, in my mind, I was totally decided what I'm going to do. And I was feel proud, I was feel happy, and I feel something like that. I got something meaningful in my life. When I reached near the Chinese embassy, suddenly the one policeman was saw me, and he was shouting. And when I crossed the road, it was just nearly to be an accident with the car. So I suddenly jumped. And when I look up, a police was very near by me. So I thought that this is time. If I not did this time, so it will be not possible to do again. And I just burned myself. And I just shout only 3 words.
And you said to me that you were feeling proud and that you were doing something meaningful, but you were facing your own death. Were you not frightened of that?
No, I'm not afraid for that. Every human being and every animals, they have to be dead one day. If I died for some meaningful reasons, I think this is the life which is useful for other people.
But what about leaving behind your friends and your family?
Yeah, on that time, I just sent the SMS to them. I just said, sorry, what I'm going to do, and if I did some mistake in my life, then sorry. And please forgive me. And after that, I switched off my mobile.
Because you didn't want them to stop you from doing it or to argue with you?
Yeah.
So what did it feel like as you set yourself on fire?
I did not feel anything. I just shouted again and again. Even I did not feel any pain.
And did the police come rushing towards you?
They stopped me between 35 yeah, 40 seconds.
So they put out the flames. But you must have been badly hurt.
Yeah. The doctor was told me that they have a 3 different skin in a body. And that was a totally burn in my left side leg.
So when you found yourself in hospital and you had not succeeded in killing yourself, what were your feelings?
It was painful. I strongly feel that what I want to do is not work. And I was useless in a bed these 3 months doing nothing.
So you wished in a way that you had succeeded, that you had succeeded in killing yourself?
Yeah, I wish that.
And what did people say to you, your friends, your family, what did they say to you as they came to visit you?
Most of my friends and my family are a bit angry and worried. They were shouting on me, why are you doing these kind of things? It will be not work.
How did you feel when they said that to you?
Nothing special, because I know they are a family, they are my friend. They are worried about me, so that's what they're saying.
But you can understand their worry, can't you?
Yeah, I understand that.
But even so, it wouldn't change your mind. You'd still think it was the right thing to do to set yourself on fire.
Yeah, but I'm ready to do that.
What do you think your father would have thought about you trying to set yourself on fire in this way?
Maybe he will be proud. I understand he will be sad, but he, in the other side, he will be proud because he's also a Tibetan.
What are your plans for the future now? Will you get involved in more protests?
Yeah, even I'm going to organize some protests in 10 March. I already decided to go to all over India.
So do you think in the end that setting fire to yourself would have been the wrong thing to do?
I don't think so. If it will be useful more, then I'm ready to do.
It seems quite extraordinary. Some people will think it's strange that somebody who's never even been to Tibet would feel so strongly and would want to lay down their life for the country. I wonder if you can explain why that is.
I think because of my father, because of my blood, because of my language, my culture, my educations. If the Tibet is freedom right now, I will be born in Tibet.
Shirab Sador speaking to me from New Delhi in India. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Coming later in the programme, the 28-year-old French woman who's about to windsurf across the Atlantic despite having a heart condition. We'll meet her later. But now, for 27 years, Christian Bethelson was a fighter. He played a leading role in the bloody civil war in his native Liberia, which claimed the lives of 250,000 people. The conflict left the country in economic ruin and overrun with weapons. But after a chance encounter in 2005, Christian became a man of peace. He now devotes his life to trying to heal the deep wounds left by Liberia's violent past. When I spoke to him from Monrovia, he began by describing his life as a soldier.
I was married to this woman called AK-47, 27 good years of bad marriage, all right, and I saw killing tribes going against tribe in the war. All the tribes were disarmed, you know, and giving the gun to another tribe. So there was total breakdown of security where nobody would value or anyway in the army.
I believe that you were involved in an incident when there was an attempt by international peacekeepers to broker a ceasefire, and you escorted Samuel Doe to the port for peace talks. Can you tell us what happened then?
Well, during the ceasefire, and Doe drove all around the principal street of Monrovia. So, but at the time, I did not know that I was going to the port. I really did not know. No soldier knew that they were going to the port, honestly. So when we got to the port, the defense minister was Bowman Barclay. So he came in and talked to us that we should disarm. So we disarmed. And when we entered the port, they carried Doe to the dock office upstairs near the dock area. So Doe went upstairs, and we were downstairs as commandos, you know, and just downstairs, you know, waiting for command, all of that. After the sudden, we just heard a sporadic firing. Boom! Pra-pra-pra-pra. I remember that, you know, it wasn't easy, you know, so nowhere to go. You don't have AK, you don't have arm to respond to bullets, so it wasn't easy. So what happened was that we began to manage, you know, some got killed. Some of our left when we joined the ship, we won the Sierra Leone, and whether I sustained a bullet wound on my foot, I left, I won the Sierra Leone, and they were treated in the military hospital in the place called Weber Four Barrack, the way I was treated in Sierra Leone.
So you're in a military hospital in Sierra Leone, and your wound eventually healed. What was your life like in Sierra Leone?
You know, I left from my family, and not knowing where my family about, so I joined a new life, and I begin to drug again and abuse of drug and just get high, you know, just go the right time. And because the memory are all gone, the memory are lost. So I lost my conscience. And, you know, as a soldier and also as a father of a family, I was forcibly leaving from my home, you know, I was taken away from my home and everything. So I was there. And I mean, it was very hard. I was living as a slave again in another country. Liberian are not a beggar, we don't beg. So I found myself in a situation where I was forced to ask for bread and everything to eat. So it was totally a nightmare for me. It was not good for me at all.
Well, Christian left the refugee camp and headed back to Liberia, which was now plunged into all-out civil war. Under the alias General Leopard, he spent the next 13 years leading rebel forces in a ruthless battle against the President Charles Taylor. When an uncertain peace arrived in 2003, he finally headed home to see his wife and children.
I saw my family dignity and pride were lost. I could not feed my family. My kids could not go to school. I met them in an unfinished building, starving to death because there was no food. Nobody was there, you know, so I was just sitting, you know, and just looking at them in a way that my kid could not go to school again. So the struggle continued again on me.
What was your reaction to being in that powerless situation? How did you react to not being able to feed the family, not being able to look after them properly?
The self-pity and everything. What I could do is, because I never had no respect for my family, so what I could do was just go on the beach and get high, you know, and get high and come back home, midnight, you know, go to bed. But at one time I sat on the tree that I couldn't continue this anymore, so I decided to see how best I can try to, you know, turn around, you know. And so what happened to me was the only skill that I had at the time was military knowledge, you know, to see how I can go, you know, into elsewhere to sell that military talent.
Christian decided that the only way he could feed his family was by returning to his life as a soldier. He set off for Ivory Coast to join a conflict there. But on that journey, his life changed forever. Near the border, when his car got stuck in the mud, he met a group of people called the Everyday Gandhis, a non-profit organisation dedicated to helping war-torn communities rebuild. Christian was drawn to their conversation.
I saw like Jake and Olapo were taking, you know, discussing peace. You know, how peace is possible, how we can live again, how we can forgive one another. So I got interested in that conversation. So the very first time in my life, you know, to be hugged by a white woman, you know, from Everyday Gandhis. So this woman hugged me and showed me love. From that movement, my story changed around, you know, and then this transformation took place in my life that, oh, even though as an ex-criminal, somebody loved me, so I need to love myself also. So I took that, you know, as a mantle. I was so happy in that movement.
It's an amazing thing that a chance meeting like that could transform your life. Why do you think it made such an impression on you?
Yeah, because I have never been loved by anybody before in my life. I needed happiness. I have never been happy before for my entire life. I have never been loved by even my family and everything. So what I was just involved in was slavery and walking, taking fetching firewood, go on the farm, you know, scratch a rest. So there was no love. So it moved me. You know, I went back home, and I think the next day, I went to meet this lady. You know, she gave me like $100. I went and bought a bag of rice. So my dignity restored back again to my family, my website. Where did he get the money from? I said, the story is just beginning. So, you know, and we bought a food, live a happy life. I began to wash the dishes from that movement on. I washed the dishes. I wear my wife's clothes. I began to... My wife said, wow, she went to church, you know, and gave her testimony in her church that my husband have turned to be a different person. And from that time on, you know, I began to work in that line. I've been a very different person. I stopped the abuse of alcohol. I stopped the abuse of drugs and everything. And so it was so huge and profound.
Well, one of the people in that group was a Liberian who calls himself Uncle Jake. He told me what Christian looked like when they first met at that muddy roadside.
When I first saw him, he looked very desperate. When I say desperate, I was in fact afraid of him because I myself had fled Liberia and I was back home for the first time in 15 years. So I didn't trust anybody because we heard a lot of horrible stories, you know, about the war, what was happening. We had to build trust. And today, here we are. That's how I met him.
Was it difficult to help him to change his life? It's difficult to help somebody to get off drugs, to get off alcohol, somebody who's been killing people for many, many years. Was it a real struggle for him to change?
It's really difficult to deal with people like Christian Pedersen. It's really difficult. To me, it was like trying to teach an old dog new trick. And his level of transformation is impressive. And I speak with he and his family almost every day. So life is good again, the way I see it. And we go to places together, we do work. We are also trying to help other young people, you know, turn their lives around the way he's done his. He's not doing drugs. He's not doing, abusing alcohol, I would say that. You know, as I see a lot of other children doing it, even in my own neighborhood, who are former child soldiers and former combatants.
What sort of work is he now involved in?
Well, our work is we call it, it's a peace building work, and what we do is we go into communities, and he knows a lot of former child soldiers, and currently we're building what we call Palaver Hut in Liberia.
You're building peace huts where people can come together to discuss how to live peacefully.
Right. In communities, in our Liberian setting, that people usually have those kind of structure where they can go and sit down and you know, discuss issues relevant to the communities. That people do that. We think that this is the way we can give back to the community that a lot of us have, you know, helped to destroy.
Uncle Jake and Christian Bettelson, now members of a group called the Earth Treasure Vase Global Healing Project. Well, now, crossing the Atlantic on a glorified plank isn't everybody's dream, but for Sarah Hébert, a 28-year-old champion windsurfer from France, it's been a driving ambition since she underwent a heart operation 6 years ago. Sarah has a heart rhythm disorder, which led to her needing an implanted defibrillator, a small device which delivers an electric shock to the heart when an abnormal rhythm is detected. But despite this, she's attempting to windsurf from Dakar in Senegal to the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe, a distance of about 4,000 kilometres across the Atlantic. When I spoke to her from Dakar, standing on the shore near the starting point, Sarah told me she grew up on the water.
I'm born in 1984 in New Caledonia, and right away I was on my sailing boat, and I sailed for 11 years with my parents and my little brother on the sailboat.
Do you remember particular places that you went to on that voyage?
From Réunion Island to Africa, Madagascar, and it was amazing for a child to discover such place with many different people, many different religion and culture, so it was very rich.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to life on dry land?
Yes, yes, for sure it was difficult. When I discovered the real life at 11 years old, I was a bit afraid because I was not used to this life with rules. You know, on a boat, you just live with the wind and with the wave. And when I just discovered school, I was a bit surprised that you have to work mathematics, and then after French, and then after the bell is ringing, so you have to go play with your friend, and then you go again. And I was not used to all this rhythm.
And did you find it boring to stay in one place for a long time?
It was good to stay in the same place, because when you are like 13, you need to stay in the same place with the same people to make you grow better, you know. But after a while, maybe I was a bit bored there.
So now tell me about your windsurfing. Why do you love windsurfing so much?
Because when you're windsurfing, you feel so free. It's unbelievable, you know. You feel adrenaline, and you just realize that how much nature has a big force and can influence your happiness. So
now tell me about your heart condition. What exactly happened? How did you find out that you had a problem?
It was in December 2005, and I had a test effort for the French Federation, and we detect that my heart had a rhythm problem. After that, I went to Paris, and the doctors told me that I had to have an implantable defibrillator, so it was quite a shock.
Was there a time when you thought you might have to give up windsurfing?
Yeah, during 3 months, I didn't know if I could continue windsurfing, but finally the doctors saw that if I could not go on the ocean, I could not live anymore, so they understood, and I went back on my windsurfing boat.
And the idea of windsurfing across the Atlantic, was that in a way an attempt to prove that you're just as good as you used to be, if not better?
Well, when I decided to cross the Atlantic Ocean, it was in 2006, the year of my implantation. And I wanted to cross the ocean because I just realized during a voyage with a sailboat that I was missing the deep ocean. But it was maybe also a way to prove to myself that I was, like yesterday, you know, able to continue all my trip and to fulfill my dreams.
And have the doctors said anything about the risks involved in taking on such a challenge?
No, now my cardiologist is really happy for me, and I saw him 1 month ago and he told me that everything was right, so it's good.
That's fantastic. Now tell me how it works, because you can't presumably windsurf 24 hours a day. Do you get breaks?
Yeah, of course. So, I will windsurf with a real windsurfing board. So I can't sleep on my windsurfing gear. I got the sailing boats following me. And the evening, I take a GPS point. I go on the boat, I sleep on the boat. And the morning, I start from the same GPS point.
What are the physical pressures on you of standing upright on that windsurfer for 8 hours a day?
It will be really difficult because I will be on the same way. So I can't turn. So my muscle will be sore. I think I will stop every 2 hours sitting on my board just to stretch a bit and eat a dry banana or something like this and continue. So for sure the five first day will be really difficult. And after, I think my body will change a bit.
Mm. And what about your mental state? I mean, what do you think about as you stand on the board for 8 hours? What goes through your mind?
It's also good to, you know, to stay quiet and just to look around and enjoy what's happening, to admire the ocean. And I also got MP3 audio to listen to music, to listen to radio podcasts and books.
Oh, you got some audio books?
Yeah.
All right. What books are you taking with you to listen to on your windsurfer?
Jules Verne. You know these stories?
What, 80,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
Yeah, exact.
That's not what you want to happen, is it?
No, for sure no.
Sarah Hebert, we'll keep in touch with her during her voyage and bring you an update. You can see pictures of her and her windsurfer on our Facebook page. But that's all from today's programme. I'm Matthew Bannister. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Do join me then if you can.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.